Sheriff says he had 100 deputies trained to enforce federal and state immigration laws.
100 of my deputies were authorized and trained by the federal government, ICE, to enforce federal immigration laws. Now, the federal court has ruled that federal training was unconstitutional, and it led to racial profiling. We will appeal this ruling.
A federal judge ruled that sheriff's deputies abused that authority by stopping drivers solely on the basis of their race. The case was brought by a group of Latino citizens who said they were being harassed. Arpaio says he'll appeal the ruling. Ted Robbins, NPR News, Tucson.
Federal investigators say the ricin-tainted letters mailed to New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg and his gun control group were postmarked Shreveport, Louisiana. So far, no arrests made. I'm Dave Mattingly, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Joyce Foundation, working to improve the quality of life in the Great Lakes region. Learn more at joycefdn.org.
Programs on WILL are made possible by Jim Rue at Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer warranties on many products. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959. 367-8121.
Welcome to Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. Dr. Gary Greenberg is a psychotherapist practicing in Connecticut. He's written about mental health for magazines and in books, including his books Manufacturing Depression, The Secret History of a Modern Disease, and The Noble Lie, When Scientists Give the Right Answers for the Wrong Reasons. His new book, The Book of Woe, The DSM, and the Unmaking of Psychiatry, came out this month from Penguin's Blue Writer Press. And no matter how well it sells, I suspect it won't do as well as the DSM itself. Dr. Greenberg, welcome to Focus.
Well, I'm glad to be here, and thank you for signaling the most important subject, which is book sales.
And I take it, as a matter of fact, I have the American Psychiatric Association's website up, and on the front page is a link to ordering the DSM-5. And I should say, if you want to buy your copy, they're not cheap. You can go to psych.org, that's psych.org. But is it true, as is what I seem to read in your book, that the DSM is a big moneymaker for the American Psychiatric Association?
Well, it has been over the years. It remains to be seen if the DSM-5 will be. The APA says that they spent $25 million to develop it, so they got to crack that nut before they can actually report profits. But the DSM-4, in its 20-year lifespan, brought in about $110 million. So they do stand to benefit from it financially if all goes well for them.
And of course, there are a lot of cases where money comes in for a reference work that people use a lot, but does the availability of that money compromise the work in any way?
Well, nobody really knows. I mean, it clearly creates a bad appearance. You know, as some people have come to say, the perception is reality. Although that might be the criterion for mental illness, too. Who knows? But the fact that a private organization controls this public trust is the real problem. And every once in a while, as in when the manual is revised, people both inside and outside the industry question, is part of the reason that they're revising the manual now, just so everybody will have to buy a new one.
Okay, although it has been quite a few years since the last one.
Yes, it has. And so if indeed there was large strides in science, then there might be the call for a wholesale revision of the DSM. However, that part of it isn't clear either. I don't know the answer to this question. I want to make that clear. And I don't spend a lot of time in my book accusing the APA of, you know, purely mercenary interests here. I just point out that they do stand to gain from it. And there are some decisions that got made along the way that indicate, first of all, that some people in the industry thought maybe it wasn't time for a revision, in particular the National Institute of Mental Health, which refused to provide any funding for the revision, which they had provided money for revisions in the past. And secondly, other psychiatrists, sort of rank-and-file psychiatrists, who wondered, well, why are you doing this right now?
Well, if you have any questions or comments for Gary Greenberg, call us at 333-9455 or toll-free at 1-800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL or 1-800-222-WILL. You can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. And we welcome your questions on Facebook and Twitter at Focus 580. Gary, I'm wondering, are there other books like this, reference books on mental illnesses and treatments issued by other people or organizations? And do you ever consult such books in your practice?
Well, not really. I mean, to your first question, not really. There are not. Actually, the answer to both questions is not really thinking about it. So let me take them one at a time, though. There's no other organization that's providing a sort of complete alternative to the APA's Diagnostic and Statistical Manual. There is a publication or a set of publications by the World Health Organization called the International Classification of Diseases, which does provide diagnostic labels and codes and some descriptions of mental disorders. It's closely harmonized with the DSM. There really isn't that much difference between the two documents, except for that the one that the World Health Organization puts out is free and available for download. As to the question of how I use it like most therapists use it, sort of cynically. First, I try to talk my clients out of using their insurance in the first place for a number of reasons, not the least of which is that a mental illness diagnosis goes on their permanent medical record. But if that's not possible, if indeed they just can't afford to pay me whatever modest fee I might propose, then I use it as a convenience. There are numbers, there are codes in there which will compel insurance companies to pay for psychotherapy.
So essentially you may translate a diagnosis in the DSM speak so that an insurance company will accept the language.
Yeah, I mean, bear in mind that very few therapists use diagnoses in their treatments. I mean, it's almost, not entirely, but it's almost irrelevant to what we do, because what we're treating are the problems people have in their lives. You know, we're mostly dealing with symptoms, sadness, worry, relationship problems, and so on. We're not really dealing with underlying disorders in the same way that, say, a physical therapist is dealing with a muscle tear. And I have to add that that's not just true about talk therapy. That's true about drug therapy as well. Psychiatrists don't treat mental disorders. There's no drug for schizophrenia. And what they treat are the symptoms that occur. There are drugs that help people with hallucinations. There are drugs that help people with anxiety and so on.
Well, is that a matter of that when you're getting into actual conditions, let's say it's something that is neurological that is affecting a person, does that go outside the realm of psychology and psychiatry into a different realm?
I mean, there's sort of a proverb that says once you've discovered the biology of a mental disorder, it becomes neurology rather than psychiatry. You know, at the moment, there are no psychiatric disorders that have established biological findings, at least not as part of the diagnosis. And what's interesting about the DSM, relevant to your question, is that the disorders listed in the DSM, nobody claims that they really exist, and in fact exist in the sense that we usually expect for diseases. That is to say, it's a kind of suffering that has an identifiable biological cause. What happens instead is that there are descriptions in the DSM, and there are constructs, there are ideas, and those ideas don't correspond very well to the little that we do know about neurochemistry.
Well, I'm wondering, because my understanding is the DSM does deal to some degree with autism, and there has been some research about cellular structures in the brain relating to people with autism.
Sure. There's been lots of research about many psychiatric disorders, but none of it's conclusive. None of it is telling us with any kind of specificity what happens in the brain when a person can be diagnosed with autism or depression or schizophrenia. These are very tantalizing findings, but there's nothing conclusive.
Not at this point, anyway.
No, not at this point, and frankly, not in the foreseeable future.
Would a psychiatrist, and I should say that you're a psychotherapist.
Yeah, I'm not a psychiatrist.
You have a PhD, an MD.
Yes, I have a PhD in psychology.
Would a psychiatrist tend to answer this question differently?
I think a psychiatrist would be more optimistic about the future But I don't think any psychiatrist could say credibly that there are biological findings that guide their diagnoses, because there aren't.
Well, this particular situation with this new edition of the DSM, the DSM-5, seems to have gathered its own critics above and beyond criticism of the DSM. Can you give a short summary of, well, what happened?
You mean in this revision?
Yeah, the history of the making of the DSM-5,
yeah, so
and the criticism, which seems to be fairly coming from a lot of places.
Well, let's remember that psychiatrists have never really liked the DSM.
But it's a psychiatric association that publishes it.
Exactly, and they use it and they need it, and it is the basis in many ways of their institutional authority. But it's always been treated like a necessary evil. In my book, I talk about it in equivalent to a colonoscopy, something that you have to submit yourself to, but that is not pleasant. And you may not believe that it's really all that good for you. So they do this because it's the only way that they have of diagnosing mental illnesses. So every time there's a revision of the DSM, our old arguments they were frozen under amber when the DSM-4 was made, or when the DSM-3 was made, and then there's a revision and the old arguments can get some air and they come back often in different ways because history has moved on. So in this particular case, what happened was that in addition to the usual arguments like how many criteria do we want to require before we can make a diagnosis of autism, there was a general concern among some very influential psychiatrists that the American Psychiatric Association was way too ambitious in its goals for the DSM, for the DSM-5. And the reason they were so ambitious was because the method that had been getting used to make diagnoses, this descriptive approach, where you, knowing that you don't have biological findings, you just create disorders and find the criteria that you will identify them by, they wanted to move to a neuroscience-based psychiatry, which is a great idea, but the science wasn't there. And so the people who saw this ambition were very concerned that essentially that the APA would go off half-cocked and make a diagnostic manual that would prove to be useless or maybe even worse, an embarrassment. And so they came out swinging, and in the course of doing that, they discovered certain things, such as that the APA had sworn all of its committee members to secrecy, such as that there was still an awful lot of industry influence, in the pharmaceutical industry influence, in the panels that were making the DSM, and so on. And so what happened was that the whole process of making the DSM-5 became riven with controversy from within the profession. And secondarily, what happened as a result of that is that the bigger flaws, the flaws not just in the DSM-5, but the DSM itself, also became obvious, because what everybody had to say in order to have the fight, they all had to say, look, these are just constructs. These aren't real diseases.
Well, this is Focus. I'm Jim Meadows, and we're talking with psychotherapist Gary Greenberg, author of The Book of Woe, The DSM, and The Unmaking of Psychiatry. The DSM is psychiatry's manual listing mental disorders and possible treatments, and the development of the latest edition has caused a lot of controversy. You can call us with your comments at 333-9455 or toll free at 1-800-222-9455. You can email us, email your questions and comments to will-talk@illinois.edu. Want to go to a phone call now? This is Mitra in Urbana on line one. And good morning. You're on the air on Focus.
Good morning. I have twofold question. One is a statement rather than a question. But did you hear that they're taking the schizoaffective out of DSM-5? And also, I was wondering if you heard about the Spiritual Emergence Network that deals with shamanic practitioners. Basically, so many shamanic practitioners have had psychotic breaks that they put spiritual problem into the back of the DSM, but it's not really used by psychiatrists very much, maybe in California or something. But, yeah, so That's kind of my twofold question statement.
Okay, Mitra. Well, thank you very much for your call.
Okay, so as to the first question, there's been a realignment of the schizophrenia diagnoses, and I wouldn't say that the schizoaffective disorder, which is what she was asking about, has disappeared. But it's not going to be identified in the same way as it was. This is one of those sort of inside baseball things, but it also indicates the problem that psychiatrists face in making diagnostic categories, which is that they can be infinitely rearranged because there's no external validation. There's no way to say this is all one disease or this is three different diseases. And so in every revision, there are these points of contention that really can't be resolved. In the end, the distinctions are in some ways arbitrary.
I'm sorry, and I was just going to go over to the second part of Mitra's question about spiritual problems.
Yeah, so as to the second question, there's a real tendency to consider anybody who has psychotic symptoms, that is, delusions, hallucinations, disturbances of thought that indicate a lack of contact with reality, to identify them as not just mentally ill, but severely mentally ill, and to treat them as such immediately, which means generally hospitalization and drugs. Powerful antipsychotic drugs. There's a small but sort of concentrated group of people who believe that, at least in some cases, psychotic breaks are spiritual emergencies in which people who are under great duress for various reasons, the way that it manifests in them is in these psychotic symptoms. I don't know what the status of spiritual emergency is in the DSM-5. I still haven't received my copy, I'm afraid. And because they embargoed the final content of the DSM-5 back in really last fall, until it arrives, I can't tell you for sure what's in there.
Okay. Well, Mitra, again, thank you very much for your call. I'm wondering, you haven't received your copy, and that must you were in the position of writing a book about the DSM and the DSM-5 with. Out having that much to go on about the DSM-5.
Well, I had plenty to go on because they've been posting the proposed revisions all the way through, plus I had cultivated quite a few sources within the organization. So it's not that I was completely in the dark, but yes, as to the final copy, I have not seen it yet. And I mean, that was somewhat of a problem for me. I mean, I obviously, for mostly commercial reasons, wanted to publish the book when the DSM itself came out. But, you know, leaving aside my little complaint, there's a kind of a academic freedom issue here. This, as I said earlier, this is a public trust. And the American Psychiatric Association has done everything they can to control the flow of information regarding it, up to and including forbidding researchers from using the proposed criteria for the DSM-5 to do research on them without first getting advance permission from the American Psychiatric Association. And since researchers might be using those data, those proposals to paint a negative picture, they were not in the position of wanting to give out that permission.
That brings up the complaints that the National Institute for Mental Health had. And I understand that they are also working on their own. I don't know if it's going to be a manual, but some sort of reference work that would be used for research into mental disorders as compared to the treatment of mental disorders.
That's correct. First of all, let's remember that DSM is not a treatment manual. It is only for diagnostic purposes, whether for research or treatment, but it doesn't tell people what you do if you've diagnosed.
Does it show, and perhaps I've been misleading listeners, does it show possible treatments?
No.
It does not.
There are no treatments in the DSM. It's very, very clear about that.
I want to make sure I make that correction. Yeah. There are no recommended treatments or possible treatments in the book.
Like every other medical specialty, the APA comes out with, guidelines for care, and those are based on DSM diagnoses, but they're separate. As to your question about the National Institute of Mental Health, the NIMH is trying to distance itself from the DSM because the DSM categories are only constructs, and increasingly that's a problem. The reason it's a problem is twofold. First of all, it creates this sort of false reality that, for instance, there is such a thing as schizophrenia. There is no such thing as schizophrenia. The head of the National Institute of Mental Health in my book, you'll see he says that. Frankly, he's not going to hide it. Schizophrenia doesn't really exist, and if you have an entire apparatus of research and treatment and devoted to a disease that doesn't exist, what you have is a situation of like you're like Alice in Wonderland. You know, you're in a parallel reality.
Okay, let's be careful when we say that schizophrenia does not exist. I take it you're not saying that's the same thing as saying that people who express symptoms which have been diagnosed with schizophrenia don't really have a problem and just need to buck up.
Thanks for making this clarification. What I mean by that is very simple. Schizophrenia doesn't exist in the same way that cancer exists. That is to say, there may be many reasons, many causes, many disease, what we think of as diseases, that would result in a person having the hallucinations and the delusions that characterize schizophrenia. But the idea that everybody who has those hallucinations and delusions is suffering from a single disease called schizophrenia, that is not true.
In the same way that a severe headache could be a migraine,
exactly.
or could be the it could be the on the onset of the rupture of a blood
exactly.
vessel in the brain.
It could be a stroke, it could be an aneurysm, or it could be a headache, and they all maybe feel the same and look the same, but until you dig into the underlying pathology, you don't know what they are.
And even at this point, you know, we think we've gone some ways in the treatment of mental disorders, and I'm sure you would hope as a therapist that you've gotten some way. You're saying that people don't know.
Yes, I'm saying that. And I'm saying that to the extent that we do know. For instance, there are some fairly relatively strong signals from genetics regarding schizophrenia and bipolar disorder. It would appear that at least some of the people that would be diagnosed with schizophrenia and or bipolar disorder, that those two disorders would appear to have a common genetic underpinning. In other words, what we normally think of as definitive of a disease category, may transcend the distinctions between schizophrenia and bipolar disorder. It may be the same disease manifesting itself either as a mood disorder on the one hand or as a psychotic disorder on the other hand.
Well, let's bring this back to the NIMH and what they're doing in this situation.
Okay. Well, they start with the assumption, I guess, that what you just said about headache is true. That is to say, that psychiatric diagnosis at this point is more about diagnosing headache or chest pain, is the example that they use, than it is about diagnosing diseases. And what they're saying is that that model has begun to hinder psychiatric research because the map that the APA, that the DSM provides of the terrain of mental illness doesn't really match up with the landscape. It's like using a map of the moon to negotiate your way around Champaign-Urbana, you know? It doesn't work. And worse than it doesn't work, it can really mislead people because if you're looking at a map and it doesn't correspond to the reality, you can get really lost. And so what the NIMH wants to do is they want to return to some basic they want to start with what we know about the brain and work outward from there. They want to start with the terrain that they can map and build the map off of that.
And I notice I have a joint statement here that was issued, I guess, about the time of the publication of the DSM-5. From the director of the NIMH, Thomas Insel, and the president-elect of the American Psychiatric Association, Jeffrey Lieberman, noting their organization's shared interest in ensuring that patients and health providers have the best available tools and information today to identify and treat mental health issues. While we continue to invest in improving and advancing mental disorder diagnostics for the future, it goes on to say, yet what may be realistically feasible today for practitioners is no longer sufficient for researchers looking forward, laying the groundwork for a future diagnostic system that more directly reflects modern brain science will require openness to rethinking traditional categories, it's increasingly evident that mental illness will be best understood as disorders of brain structure and function that implicate specific domains of cognition, emotion, and behavior, and that this is the focus of the NIMH's Research Domain Criteria Project.
Yes, all of that. That's the statement that they issued after Dr. Insel from the NIMH hurled a grenade at the APA, at the diagnostic manual. He came out a few weeks before that statement was made. That was the kumbaya moment that followed the moment of strife when Insel said that the DSM is not valid.
Okay.
And that the NIMH was no longer going to be using it. I don't know if he meant to throw the APA under the bus, but certainly that's how a lot of people took it.
And hence this statement in which, well, it ends, by continuing to work together, our two organizations are committed to improving outcomes for people.
Yeah. I mean, and all of it's true, by the way. They're not making that up. It's not merely window dressing. But if you really parse that statement, you come out with this question, okay, so you're saying treatment and research are entirely separate domains, that research is no longer going to go along the lines of what clinicians are doing. Well, then what are clinicians doing? You know? Well, the answer is clinicians are treating people based on their symptoms and not on their mental disorders. Clinicians are increasingly, like the NIMH, not paying all that much attention to the DSM.
Okay. Well, that raises a question and something to ponder. Let me go into the break now, and then we can talk about where does this leave the DSM-5 and what do you think its future is. And we can talk about that right after this short break. This is Focus on WYLL.
Hey, can I ask you a question?
Sure.
If we're meeting for the first time today on a train, would you find me attractive?
Of course.
Before Midnight is the third film following the relationship of two lovers who met on a train in Vienna in the 1995 film Before Sunrise. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with the director, Richard Linklater, and the stars Julie Delpy and Ethan Hawke. Join us.
Weekdays at 11 a.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
Support comes from the Yoga Institute of Champaign-Urbana, with beginner-level instruction in Iyengar yoga and special classes for men, women, teens, seniors, knees, low back, neck, and shoulders. New classes start the first week of June. Details at 344-YOGA.
And welcome back. I'm Jim Meadows. We're on Focus with Gary Greenberg, author of The Book of Woe, The DSM and the Unmaking of Psychiatry. It's published by Penguin's Blue Rider Press. The DSM is a widely used reference manual outlining mental illnesses. It's published by the American Psychiatric Association, and the new edition, the DSM-5, came out just the other day this month. It's you can order it at the APA's website, psych.org, but you may have to wait a while because Gary is still waiting for his copy.
Well, I'm getting a complimentary copy, so I may not be. They may be sending out to the paying customers first.
Okay. Well, I'm glad they're still thinking of you.
Well, you know, they didn't for whatever reason. I'm getting a complimentary copy because I was a collaborating investigator in the field trials that they conducted, and even though the press office officially wasn't talking to me, the research department continued to be talking to me. Whether they figured out that I was the same person, I honestly don't know. I didn't do anything to conceal it, but on the other hand, I didn't advertise it. And part of the pay for being a collaborating investigator, in addition to having my name listed in the back of the book and immortalized in that fashion, is that I get a free copy of the DSM-5.
Well, you can call with your questions and comments for Gary Greenberg at 333-9455. Our toll-free 1-800-222-9455. Our email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. We're on Facebook and Twitter at Focus580. Going by the draft copies you've seen and what people have said is going to happen, what are some of the major changes in the DSM-5 from past editions?
Well, some of the biggest changes have to do with disorders of childhood, one of them being Asperger's syndrome, which is also diagnosed in adults but largely in children, is going to disappear, or has disappeared. It no longer is an official mental illness. So, you know, cynically, you could say that means everybody who had it is now cured.
But what do they do with the symptoms that
those
been...
the people with those symptoms will be now diagnosed along what's called the autism spectrum. And the expectation, at least the official expectation, is that most of the people who would have been diagnosed with Asperger's disorder will instead receive a diagnosis of autism spectrum disorder. Whether that turns out to be correct remains to be seen. More to the point, what remains to be seen is what happens when a group of people who have formed their identity around a particular diagnosis no longer have the imprimatur of the American Psychiatric Association to call that diagnosis of mental disorder, and that makes a big difference.
Do you think that identity of, well, I'm an Aspie, and this is why things are the way they are with me, has that been helpful?
I think it's been tremendously helpful. Yeah, I mean it's you know I'm pretty skeptical about the DSM, but and about psychiatric diagnosis. But one thing is undeniable: when you give people a label for their problems, you help them. And in the case of Asperger's, what among the things that they were helped to weren't just treatments and other services like school services. They were helped to self-acceptance. They were helped to community. They were helped to being accepted by the larger world. They were helped by coming to think of themselves as, you know, one particular neurological type in a neurodiverse universe. So it was very helpful to have that diagnosis. It may have been too helpful. The diagnosis may be the victim of its own success.
What does this mean? Well, I assume maybe a psychiatrist may continue to treat people showing these symptoms as they have before. But if the DSM is being used by, say, insurance companies or school districts, and they see these symptoms now being a low-level functioning autism rather than Asperger's, what does that mean for the patient?
So nobody knows. I mean, then you bring up a really interesting point, two points, actually. One of them is that psychiatrists and all of us mental health clinicians are told explicitly that even if a patient doesn't meet the criteria, they can still be given the diagnosis if, in our judgment, they have the disorder. Now, I'm not sure exactly what that means. It seems to cancel out the whole point of a diagnostic manual, but to get to your question, that would seem to indicate that if my concern as a clinician is that the kid gets services, then I'll give the diagnosis that will get the kid the services. And since there's no external validation, there's nothing really to stop me from doing that. On the other hand, school systems, which are motivated to not give services, not because they're bad guys, but because they don't have the money, could use these new criteria, could employ psychologists and psychiatrists who will use the new criteria in a really stringent fashion to restrict services. The whole question of getting services underlies much of the change that we're talking about. The official line is that Asperger's kids weren't getting enough services, and by folding them into the autism diagnosis, which is considered to be a more severe disorder, they might qualify for more services.
I'd imagine they, on the school level, they might be, if they're considered autistic, they might be shunted off to a different special education program, a different line item on their budget.
Exactly. I mean, these things get really sort of wonky at that level, but they are important in people's lives. And one of the things that we just don't know is what happens when people who want a diagnosis are deprived of the diagnosis. We know what happens when gay people stopped being considered mentally disordered. That really was part of what created the opportunity for gay people to, you know, sort of shed the stigma of homosexuality over the last 40 years. But we don't know about what happens in reverse.
Well, let's go ahead. I'm sorry we had a caller, and if our caller, Stephen Urbana, can give us another try, we'd like to get right to him. And let me remind people of the phone number. That's 333-9455. Toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. You're one person who's been raising concerns about the DSM-5. What sort of concerns were other people raising?
Well, the biggest concern was that the DSM-5, in its ambitions, would create a situation where even more people were diagnosed and treated for mental illness. And that was especially the concern of Alan Francis, the psychiatrist who ran the DSM-4 revision. He was very concerned about what he saw as diagnostic epidemics that resulted from the DSM-4, and he saw the people running the DSM-5 making the same mistakes that he felt, in retrospect anyway, he had made, largely having to do with letting in untested new diagnoses. So that was his concern. There are a couple problems with his concerns, though. I mean, they're well taken, and he's a brave man for coming forward and taking on his colleagues and earning their wrath. But nobody knows. There's no reason to think that the DSM-5 is going to actually increase the prevalence of mental disorders, even if they've added disorders that look like they're going to attract a lot of people. Or, you know, they're going to end up being applied to a lot of people. And because what we do know is that over the years, as diagnoses have been added to the DSM since 1980, the overall prevalence of mental disorders, the numbers of people in the population who meet the criteria for any mental disorder, has not gone up at all. So there seems to be very little relationship between what's actually in the DSM and the prevalence. And the reason for that is because the DSM-3, which came out in 1980, was intentionally designed to capture as many people as possible. And it was successful. And ever since then, somewhere between 25 and 30% of us qualify for a mental disorder in any given year, and 50% of us in our lifetimes. This has not changed, and there's no reason to think it's going to change with DSM-5. What will change, of course, are the specifics, who gets diagnosed with which disorder, and that could make a difference. But one area it won't make a difference in is treatment. Treatment and diagnosis are not very closely connected. People with anxiety disorders get antidepressants. People with psychotic disorders get anti-anxiety drugs, and so on. You know, as I said before, they're not treating mental disorders. They're treating symptoms, and they're treating them mostly empirically by trial and error. More to the point, most of the prescriptions, at least when it comes to antidepressants that are written in this country, three-quarters of them are written without the benefit of a psychiatric diagnosis at all. So the concern about overtreatment is, I think, unrelated to the DSM. There's no question we have an overtreatment problem, but I don't think it has much to do with the diagnostic manual.
Okay. The problem is the diagnostic manual does not affect treatment. Well, what does it affect?
It affects people's identities. It affects the way that we think about ourselves, and it gives us this very powerful vocabulary for whether it's, you know, superficial name-calling or a much more profound understanding of self and other. It gives us a language, and that language seems to have, as I said earlier, it seems to be scientific, but in some ways it isn't really scientific at all. So in that respect, what the DSM does and why it's important is that it establishes the authority of psychiatry. Without a coherent diagnostic system, it's hard to imagine that people would take psychiatry as seriously as they do.
Well, do you think that the field needs something in the role that the DSM is trying to fulfill?
Well, let's put it this way. When they didn't have it, when the DSM was a totally ignored 100-page pamphlet that nobody paid attention to and nobody talked about, they ran into a crisis of credibility. People started to doubt that psychiatrists knew what they were talking about and that they were entitled to any kind of research money. And now that they've done it and they've got this manual, they're running into the same credibility crisis.
So the credibility crisis has not changed.
Exactly. So,
is that because the manual makes no difference, or because the manual is poorly composed?
I think that it's because the nature the project is doomed. they're trying to account for psychological suffering in terms that lend themselves to medical understanding. And it is so far proven impossible to do that.
I mean, it's just something like, you know, you can build the Tower of Babel as high as you want, but you're not going to reach the heavens.
There you go. I think that's exactly right. And every time it collapses, you may think that you may think that it was because you used this kind of brick or that kind of brick, but the real problem is that the structural is a structural flaw. And every time you build it, it's going to collapse again. Now, do I think that's a good thing? Not at all. I don't relish that. I think that the fact of the matter is that there are many people who have benefited from psychiatry. However, unfortunately, there's very little understanding of who does benefit from psychiatry and why. You know, there are many cases in which the drugs that are supposed to help people or the treatments that are supposed to help people simply don't help them. And other cases where drugs that you wouldn't expect to help people help them. So psychiatry remains a kind of an empirical treatment. It remains an old line intervention, and I wouldn't want to take away its successes, but I would want to point out that even the best psychiatrist can't tell you why person A responds to the treatment that person B does not.
You say strictly psychiatry and the use of medication and not psychotherapy and the
right.
talk
well,
therapy
I,
that
I,
you
I,
and that you and that you use.
Yes, and so what I said earlier, you know, what I talk therapies are even less tied to diagnoses than drug therapies. You know, I'll tell you right out, psychotherapy is a placebo treatment.
By that you mean?
By that I mean that it doesn't work by any specific, mechanism. It works by virtue of the relationship between the therapist and the client.
Okay.
And it's very difficult to specify how that relationship works or what it is or why it works with some people and it doesn't with others. With a placebo treatment, you would expect a certain variability, the same variability that you would expect in all of human relations.
Mm-hmm. This is Focus. I'm Jim Meadows, and there's still time for your questions and comments for Gary Greenberg about the DSM, a manual for the treatment of mental illness, which he writes about in his new book, The Book of Woe, the DSM and the Unmaking of Psychiatry. One thing, we were talking about Alan Francis, a psychiatrist involved in a past revision of the DSM, who is now very suspicious of this new revision. And you talk about your relationship with Alan Francis in the book,
mm-hmm.
and charges by him that you were or could be interpreted as attacking psychiatry in the broader sense when you criticized the DSM.
Yeah, that was his concern, not just with me, but in general, was that what he was doing would be used by critics of psychiatry to undermine the profession, and I think he's correct about that. I don't think that was an unfounded fear, but I also think that he wasn't just making technical comments or criticisms about the DSM-5. He was talking about quite openly about his whole point was, look, this is not a book of real diseases. This is a book of constructs, and as such, it's really fragile. And so whatever you do with it is bound to cause trouble. Look, if you don't have a test to say whether or not a child has bipolar disorder, then you'd better be really careful when you talk about bipolar disorder such that over-ambitious or over-helpful psychiatrists don't just unwarrantedly diagnose children with bipolar disorder and then treat them. Given that there are no tests, given that there is no validity, you have to be even that much more careful. So his critique was really a critique of the whole process. It's exactly the critique that many people make. Now, I think Francis was unduly concerned that I somehow want to take down the entire industry of psychiatry. I just want people to be aware that of what the actual limitations of psychiatry are, what its knowledge base is, and how it, as a profession, has been confused and worried for 150 years about its credibility, especially as it relates to its diagnostic system.
Well, I brought that up with in mind of an event that happened in the Illinois legislature last week. The Illinois House rejected a proposal which was brought up in the context of the release of the DSM-5 and the controversy over it.
The law about Asperger's?
This was specifically a House resolution which would have created a task force to comb through Illinois laws and regulations looking for the influence of psychiatry that, in the words of the sponsor, may have been recently discredited. And the sponsoring representative, Chicago Democrat Mary Flowers, says she wanted to start a conversation in the of psychiatry. We've seen the headlines in the newspaper, she says, about doctors over-medicating adults as well as children because there's money involved. And In its opposition, another lawmaker noted that one of the groups supporting the resolution was a group with was a group with ties to the Church of Scientology, which I think you've mentioned in your book, and they are really they really are enemies of psychiatry in a way that you certainly are not.
Yeah, well, you know that, and I know that, but unfortunately, the American Psychiatric Association doesn't make those distinctions. And that's really the saddest part of this whole story to me. Not that, you know, they're angry with me. I don't blame them for that. But that whether it's me or anybody else, every critic of psychiatry is it might as well be a member of the Church of Scientology. There's this attempt to say that, you know, when you run out of argument, the best thing to do is to revert to the ad hominem. And that's unfortunately been a lot of the tenor of the response, not just to my criticism, but to many people's, including Dr. Francis's criticism.
Mm-hmm.
He's been branded, if not as an anti-psychiatrist, then as a, you know, self-interested old codger who just doesn't want to see things change.
Well, this particular resolution was rather soundly defeated.
Mm-hmm.
But do you think this sort of thing of a task force to review laws and regulations relating to psychiatry, do you think it could be useful, or could it be misused in itself?
Well, of course it could be misused in itself in the legislative process. Illinois, of course, has a reputation for its state government, but it probably isn't any worse than any other state government, and I'm not sure that's the mechanism. But what is really important about that proposal is that what we know now is that this private guild can control too much of what's important to the public, and therefore that sort of screams out for some kind of remedy, some kind of oversight, some perhaps even taking this initiative away from the American Psychiatric Association and putting it into the public domain. Not that that's going to solve all the problems, but it's certainly going to make the process more transparent. A government can't say, as the APA did, we are now taking down all these proposed criteria and we're making them go away and nobody else can see them again.
Well, on the other hand, I mean, what goes on with psychiatry in other countries?
Honestly, I don't know the answer to that, except to say that most countries are dependent on the American Psychiatric Association for the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, because frankly, nobody else wants to do the job.
Okay, and in the WHO document you mentioned is...
Well, that's free. I mean, that's something that's made by an international group, but with heavy APA influence.
Have you seen that document? Does it look similar?
No, it's a completely different kind of listing. Instead of a criteria, there are what they call prototypes, paragraphs describing what these people look like. You know, if you have a diagnosis, this is what depression looks like. It's a descriptive paragraph rather than a list of bullet point criteria.
Is that more or less useful, or is it just a wash?
Actually, I think clinically it's at least as useful. But research-wise, it's not, because it's not as reliable. You know, you're less likely to get agreement, or I should say you're more likely to get agreement if you have a list of criteria that every clinician is looking for. It's more likely that clinicians will agree about the diagnosis for any given patient.
We're down to the last couple of minutes for the program. I did want to ask, what do you think is going to happen from here with this sort of criticism of the development of the DSM-5? Do you think this is a turning point for psychiatry and the treatment and of mental health disorders, and how it's considered not just by practitioners and the people providing treatment, but also by governments and the people who are paying for the treatment?
Well, yeah, I don't think that there's going to be a wholesale abandonment of either the DSM or psychiatry. I think that the reverberations from the revision of the DSM-5 will echo down the years. I'm not sure exactly what form it will take, but I think it's going to force a reappraisal in many quarters of the relationship between, first of all, between this public trust and the private guild. I think it's going to, I doubt the APA will undertake this again. I think they'll do everything they can to avoid a wholesale revision.
They've talked about doing minor revisions, that there might be a DSM-5.1,
yeah,
that sort of
right.
thing.
And I think that one of the virtues of that is it will keep the changes underneath the radar. Or if the changes do hit the public, if there's a particular change, it will only be the particular change rather than, as what happened here, the whole idea. But I think that in the face of the absence of any alternative, I think that the problem will just be out there as something that people know and ignore as much as possible. And I'm not looking, I don't anticipate any grand solution coming along any more than I anticipate some grand disintegration coming along. Psychiatry is going to limp along, like we all do.
Now, that's barring any new and major developments in the field of not just psychiatry, but in treating mental disorders
in
general.
If there's some miraculous breakthrough in the area of neuroscience, as in the National Institute of Mental Health Initiative, then everything will change. But not just psychiatry, but the entire way we understand a human being will change. Because what they're talking about there is unraveling the mysteries of consciousness. But I'm not holding my breath on that one.
Okay. Well, we've been talking today with psychotherapist and mental health reporter Gary Greenberg. His new book from Penguin's Blue Rider Press is The Book of Woe, the DSM, and the Unmaking of Psychiatry. And the DSM-5, the new edition of the DSM, is available now from the American Psychiatric Association. You can find more information on their website at psych.org. And Gary, I think we have a link to your website as well if we go to will.illinois.edu/focus, but you might want to give it at this point.
It's garygreenbergonline.com.
Okay. Gary Greenberg, thank you very much for coming on Focus.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
And we welcome any additional thoughts you have about today's program at will.illinois.edu/focus. Today's show was produced by Lindsay Moon. Other members of our Focus team are Pam Dempsey and Kimberly Cronick. Mike Pritchard is our technical director today, handling your calls. Tomorrow on Focus, we will welcome back meteorologist Ed Kieser, an old hand at WYLL. He'll be talking about severe weather, both the severe weather that's already hit the nation this spring and the severe weather that could come this summer. Hurricane season's coming up, maybe not an immediate problem for the Midwest, but it's one of the things that we'll be talking about on the program, as well as discussing what to watch out for closer to home and how to stay safe during any severe storms. Remember, Focus is live each weekday morning at 10. There's a replay at 8 p.m. on AM 580 and will.illinois.edu. You can go to that website. You can also listen to past programs going back years, actually. And you can sign up for our free downloadable podcast. That's at will.illinois.edu/focus. I'm Jim Meadows. This is Focus on WILL.
Leonard Seed Service supports agricultural programming on WILL as an additional service to its customers. Leonard Seed Service is an independent dealer providing DeKalb and Asgro seed products to farmers throughout East Central Illinois via the Asgro on-demand bulk soybean handling system. Leonard Seed Service, 217-497-2270.
Good Thursday morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the marketplace, where U.S. corn futures are lower today amid what has been deemed to be profit-taking after the run-up that we've seen in the last week or so, where corn futures have rallied more than 50 cents. Still, there is the potential for this corn market to go higher, as many analysts are starting to pencil in a 3 million acre reduction in corn planting due to the excess of rain over the past week and the rain that is forecast in the week to come, as in many places where corn is not planted, standing water is sitting and making the likelihood that preventive planting or a change to soybeans will occur. If you do that pencil work, all of a sudden you're looking at ending stocks instead of 2 billion bushels, something along the lines of 1.1 to 1.3 billion bushels, and that is a significant difference, although still enough corn to take care of our needs. Let's go ahead and look at particulars. In Kansas City, July wheat 738 down 9 and 3/4. 3/4. July wheat in Chicago, 691 3/4, down 11. July corn, 653 1/2, down 11 1/2. December at 559 1/4, down 6 1/2. July soybeans, 1495 1/2, down 6 1/4. November at 1285 1/4, down 3 1/4. July soybean meal, 441.80, down 250. July soybean oil, 48.40, down 23. June live cattle, 129, 117.5, down 20. August feeders, 145.55, down 7.5. You're listening to Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD3 Urbana. From the